This is the third and final lecture. I plan to have two parts to it. The first part is about deformation invariance of Purigena and the finite generation canonical ring, and then the second part about applying algebraic geometry to the complex Neumann problem. I may not be able to do the second part because I was a bit slow in the first two lectures. So first we have to finish leftover from the second lecture. Okay. That is actually about the deformation invariance of Purigena. We start with the background of the finite generation canonical ring and minimum order program. We have been talking about pluricanonical embeddings because of the situation with quotient of ball, quotient of disk, and compact Riemann surface of genus at least two. Okay. This also has something to do with pluricanonical embedding, except that it may not be an embedding. So the important point about a finite generation is that we want to describe geometric things by algebra. So instead of a manifold, we describe its Meromorphic function field. Okay. So of course, given isomorphism of function field, the manifold may not be the same. It will be up to blow up and blow downs and so forth. Okay. So then the question is there a good representative, sort of a minimal representative for this class? And when you look at the pluricanonical sections, the pluricanonical sections are not affected by blow up and blow down. So when you look at this very simple situation, if you have a compact complex manifold X, another one Y, and assume that they are bihalomorphic outside a subvariety Z of codimension at least two, then you take an element as a pluricanonical section, you pull it back, of course, it is a pluricanonical section here. On the other hand, if you take a pluricanonical section here and push it down, then outside this codimension two set on X, of course, is a pluricanonical section. But it is a section of a line bundle on X, so it extends across codimension two. Therefore, they are the same. Okay. So when you look at pluricanonical sections, you are unaware of blow ups and blow downs. So to get a good representative, you look at the ring of the pluricanonical sections, because it's invariant under blow ups and blow downs. Okay. And now, if you are able to use the canonical ring as a finely generated ring to embed, or actually not quite embedding, to get a map, it's not completely well defined everywhere, then you have the image. The image is the minimal model. Okay. And so the question is whether you could find a basis for it to generate the ring. Because if you don't have it, then you don't know which pluricanonical section you want to use to help you map, because the image will be different. So we will look at the case of general type. That means a lot of such sections are out with. So if it's finely generated, we can use it to define a rational map. And the image may not be regular, but the image has certain properties, namely it's Q-Cartier. That means you take the regular part, you have the canonical line bundle, and if you take some power of it, appropriate power, then it can be extended to a line bundle over Y, so it's Q-Cartier. And then there is some constraint on the Jacobian determinant. If you have a manifold, you blow it up, then there's the Jacobian determinant here, because you compare the canonical line bundle. The Jacobian determinant, of course, will have integer coefficients. But here you may not have integer coefficients, but you have positive rational numbers. And such a thing is the minimal model. So the minimal model of the conjecture is to show that it's finally generated. Okay. So now I want to link this to deferential invariance of Purie genera. Okay. So last time we discussed about this problem, and it's still open for the Kähler case. But let's look at the algebraic case here in this case. If you look at the initial fiber, and because semi-continuity, the invariance of Purie genera simply means that the map is surjective. So look at the simple cohomology exact sequence, multiplication by T here. So surjective means that it's the vanishing cohomology. So the question is whether it's zero. Of course, if K is ample, then you can make it zero. The question is, K, of course, may not be ample because it's general type, so you may have some zeros and so forth. But when you have zero, you are still okay because you have the vanishing theorem of the generalization of Kodaira vanishing theorem, namely Kawamata, Feedback, and Nadel. Okay. But you still have some conditions for it. So if you indeed have the minimal model, then you pass on to the minimal model if the minimal model has a parameterized version. And there, for the minimal model, because the canonical line bundle is numerically effective in that case, so we could get the vanishing of cohomology from Kawamata, Feedback, Nadel kind of thing, and therefore we'll get the extension. Yeah. But this requires not only the minimal model but the parameterized version of minimal model. Okay, so that's one link. So before the invariance of Purie genera problem was solved, people thought that maybe it's more difficult than a minimal model program because it requires a parameterized version. But it turns out that it is far easier than that. So now let's look at the other direction. Suppose you have definite invariance of Purie genera, can you get finite generation canonical ring? Okay. It depends on how the invariance of Purie genera is proved. And the way it's proved, the way I did it, is to extend it by some technique. This is a Purie canonical extension technique. And this makes it possible to get the argument by induction. Because the main thing is that the sections here may have some base point set, may have some common zeros. And then you restrict it there, and get the finite generation there and then extend out. Then you can do it. But of course, the challenge is that there are a lot of singularities here that makes things very complicated. Okay. And as a matter of fact, there's the algebraic proof and analytic proof. They both actually use this. Okay. Now, the algebraic proof actually handles the singularity, makes it extremely complicated to handle the singularity. The analytic proof I'm using does not use it directly, but uses the method that proves this. Okay. So it makes things easier to handle. So there's a big link between the two. Okay. So I want to make a remark about the lower volume bound for the manifold of general type. It's also done by the Purie canonical extension. Tsuji's idea, and then Takayama and Hagen McKernan took the idea and added the component of Purie canonical extension. Because without a Purie canonical extension, this idea wouldn't work, and that actually is the key. So after that, one could get the lower bound because of the induction and use Purie canonical extension. However, the effective version is still open, I think. Okay, so this is equivalent to the statement that if you take a Purie canonical section with some m, depending on n, this is bigger than or equal to, it's a misprint. And then you get a meromorphic map into the projective space with images dimension n. Okay, so explicit bound is not known. So let me tell you about the proof of the invention of Bruce Jenner. The reason is that the final generation uses the same idea analytically. So if you take, suppose you want to show that some element here in a pre-canonical section can be extended. Okay. Now, one naive thing is that you can write this as a sum of the products of canonical sections. Then you have no trouble because each canonical section can be extended because of the Hodge theory. Okay. So actually, that's the reason why things work. Then you say, of course, how can you write it in such a way? You cannot write it such a way, but you can modify it a little bit. How do you modify a little bit? The modification consists of using the local version and twist it by eight. So it's known as the local generation multiplier ideal shift. So what does it mean? You want to write down the M canonical section as the sum of products. Okay. So in particular, you only need to do it one step, right? As M minus one and so forth. Okay. So that means it's going to be generated by M minus one, and the coefficient would be a canonical section. Okay. Now let's look at the local version. It's generated by M minus one canonical section globally, but the canonical section, the coefficient, is allowed to be local. That's what I mean by the local version. And now then you say, what use is it if it's a local version? And actually, we also relax a bit. We express it only after we twist the section by the canonical section of an ample line bundle. Okay. Now after you twist it, you can extend it. That means it's called global generation of multiplier ideal shift. Because when you want to use expressing things locally, It's only by the ideal generation theorem of Skoda. It's a matter of the vanishing order. Okay, so it's a matter of something belonging to some multiplier ideal shift. So an integral is finite. So this is only a question of global generation of multiplier ideal shift. Okay, which I'm going to explain further. And then you stick in the A also, and then you get rid of the A later by starting with a high power of what you want to extend, get an A and then take a root and then get rid of it later. So that's how it's done. Okay. And then all you can do finally is take the root to get rid of it. You can only do it with absolute value because taking the root wouldn't make that much sense. And then what you have is just extension of a metric. And once you extend a metric, then by the Osawa Taguchi kind of extension, you can extend the thing. So that's the main idea. Very simple. Okay. So it consists of these steps, the twisting by ample, global generation of multiplier ideal shift, and taking roots to get rid of the eight. Okay. So let's make more precise what I just said. Okay, so you have locally the SM, you generate globally, and so forth, and maybe I'll skip because it just takes too long. Okay, I'll skip a number of times. So I want to tell you precisely what global generation multiplier ideal shift means. You take a compact manifold, and you take a holomorphic line bundle with a metric semi-positive curvature current, and here's the main point that E is ample line bundle, sufficiently ample, so that at every point you have quite a number of elements in the section module. They vanish to order at least n plus 1 and do not simultaneously vanish outside P. Then, if you twist it by E and the canonical line bundle, then global things generate the multiplier ideal shift. Okay. So that's the main point. So that locally you could do it according to this very simple idea. So the extension of Osawa Taguchi says the following, that you have a holomorphic family, actually algebraic family here, and you have a line bundle with a metric, and if you have an L value N form, you have a fiber dimension, this is a zero here, this is Y0, it's fiber dimension N, then it can be extended to an n plus 1 form on the whole manifold if it's finite respect to the metric. So the extension becomes an extension of the metric that allows us to take roots of the absolute value. That's the whole point. Otherwise, you cannot get rid of the positive twisting. And then you say, why do we need the positive twisting? Because the global generation of modified ideal shift, we need it to use Nakayama's lemma to get it. So we have to get rid of it later by taking roots. And when you take root, you use absolute value, so you can only do it in the sense of a metric. And therefore, after you extend a metric, you can extend it. So that is the main proof. Very, very simple, as a matter of fact. So that's the induction argument. I'll skip. I told you already that you step by step, you do it. Okay. And then taking roots here. And then the towers, okay, now here, I finished it. So here starts the third lecture. Okay. Now I hope that I told you enough worth your time sitting here. I mean, I had to go a little bit faster. Okay. Yeah. And so here starts the whole thing. So this analytic proof of the finite generator canonical ring for the case of general type. And I posted quite a number of preprints. Actually, a lot of them are just conference proceedings and so forth, like the kind of things I'm talking about here. So I posted them. And then there's an algebraic proof I mentioned to you about, which actually uses the pluricanonical extension, but then wanted to handle the singularities very carefully. Okay. So now let's do the analytic proof and tell you what is involved. Okay. Instead of using a pluricanonical extension, I'm going to use the techniques involved, namely global generation modified ideal shift, adding an ample line bundle, and taking roots, and so forth. Okay. And so we will use directly the ingredients. So first of all, let's remark that the algebraic geometric problems can always be converted to Stein manifolds. So theoretically, if you are an excellent analyst, you could solve all problems in algebraic geometry because they are all can be converted to the Stein manifold situation. So if you have a compact complex manifold, you could use projection to make it a branch cover over the projective space. And then you have a line bundle over it, you can take away the pole set and zero set of some section. And then you would get a Stein manifold spread over Cn. The section that makes the line bundle trivial outside the Zariski open set will be used to get a metric, so that L2 respect to the metric would mean that you have extension to a section of the original line bundle. So here it is, that you have this section S and you put it in to adjust it, so that if you can solve it, the L2 over the Stein manifold, then F times S can be extended to holomorphic section. Okay. So that's just the standard technique of converting algebraic geometry to analysis. So here is the main point. The main point is to express a pluricanonical section, say M section, in terms of, let's say, M prime canonical section with M prime smaller. Okay. So this is precisely the step for the invariance of pregenera when I try to say that I want to express an M canonical in terms of M minus 1 canonical. It's the same thing. Okay. And there you use global generation, and here essentially the same thing, but it's more precise. Namely, to extend it, the F, the normal F, would be constrained by the norms of G. For example, you take the soup norm, the soup norm should be no more than the soup norm of G here. Okay. But we use L2, so you are obligated to raise a certain power N or something, because of the integrability from polar coordinates. And then, you can stick in any, e to the power minus psi, psi is Purisa harmonic. Now this part is important, because this is the part that enables you to convert algebraic geometry to Stein manifold. You remember the section was put in here, okay? so that you could get back. So this actually is the main tool for doing things. And another thing is vanishing and freeness. I already told you about, you get the modified ideal shift, and then there's the theorems A and B corresponding to it. So one is the vanishing theorem called Kalawada-Feedback-Nadel, which we discussed before, that corresponds to theorem B. Another is the global generation of modified ideal shifts corresponding to theorem A, okay, which I just discussed. So these are the tools. Okay. Now, so first one looks at Skoda's generation, which try to express the M canonical in terms of M prime canonical with a smaller M prime. Okay. We convert it to the Stein manifold case and then use Skoda. Now, you could also write it down without this conversion. That means you go through Stein manifold, go through Skoda, and then back. And then you would get this result. Namely, you have a line bundle, and you have certain elements. So, like, for example, M prime canonical sections. And then you want to look at the higher ones. Let's say you need only one higher, because inductively you need only two at once, expressed in terms of the G's. But there's the integrability involved. Integrability means L2 of this ratio of certain power. So we express in terms of modified ideal shift, that is what it is. So if you have integrability here for this one, the solution will have integrability for one left here. Okay. So this is just rewriting it without going through this Stein manifold thing. Okay. Now, but the important thing is that if you know that the line bundle is free, then whatever in the numerator does not offer any trouble, because they have no common zero. Integrability is clear, so you get right away finite generation. Okay, so there's no trouble. Okay, so this is an example that you get finite generation if you have let's say ample case or some freeness just by Skoda. Now you don't need anything else. Okay, so the main thing is that you worry these sections which you hope to be the generators may have some zeros in common. So when you put them in an absolute value square in the denominator, raise a certain power, they would make non-integrability. That's the main trouble. Okay, and you don't know which ones will be used. So one thing I try is just to put all of them together. And of course, in order to be able to sum, you have to adjust it by the power. And you attach some epsilon here, positive epsilon m, that decreases fast enough to guarantee convergence. Because we only worry about the vanishing order, you know, whether we put in a denominator, whether it's finite. We don't really worry about the value. So therefore, the epsilon doesn't matter. So this is called a metric of maximum regularity or minimum singularity, whatever you call it. So this is the metric for the canonical line bundle. It's the most regular or least singular. Okay. So a moment ago we saw the free case, you get finite generation. So the vanishing of this thing is the main culprit, the main trouble. So if the vanishing order is precisely achieved, which means that you take some finite sum here, partial sum, and you compare to the big one, of course the big one is in general bigger than this, but if this one dominates a certain constant times the big one for some adjustment of the epsilons, then I say that the vanishing order are precisely achieved. Now the vanishing order is not a number, because they may vanish on some subvariety or infinite number of subvarieties with different ones, you don't know. Okay, so they are precisely achieved if they are comparable, then you have finite generation, no trouble. The same proof as before. So the generation will be like that, and you put in some factorial because you just want to have one grading otherwise. So here is the proof. I mean, you just put in a denominator and you adjust this, this will be e to the power minus psi in Skoda's theorem. You need it in order to make this thing make sense, because they belong to different line bundles. Okay. So that's why they are precisely comparable. And then you can express in terms of m canonical with a smaller m and keep on doing. Okay, so that's the finite generation. It's a matter of looking at these vanishing orders. So here is the main challenge, is the actual vanishing order of the m canonical section. So there are two things being involved. One is that you can take roots, because when you look vanishing order is absolute value, you can take roots. So you can go to a higher m canonical and take roots back to comparison. And the precise achievement means that if you take actual m canonical section and compare with a multi-value m canonical section, we usually would have lower vanishing order because you are allowed more and then take the roots. So the main thing is comparing two. Okay. So you have something that has multi-valued, you want to be able to convert it to actual section, not multi-value. The multi-value thing gives you the metric. So the main challenge is to convert a metric to actual section. That's it. And that's the reason why the global generation of multiple ideal shift is important, because the multiple ideal shift is given by the metric. If your global generation means that you will achieve the vanishing order already by actual global section. So that's why the global generation is important, and the vanishing theorem and so forth. And that is the same method as the plurigenera. Okay. So we want to handle this. So now let's look at multiple ideal shifts. So you wondered where multiple ideal shifts come in. Okay. So let's look at the crucial estimate, the one we had before. A moment ago, I put e to the power minus something. It's the same as this thing, because e to the power minus something is the same as 1 over this. So we're just rewriting it. Okay. So this actually is the crucial estimate. Right? You can do this for m, then you can express this m canonical in terms of m0 canonical. You can just keep doing it. Yeah. And the challenge is that we don't have this, because the actual vanishing order of sections may be different from the vanishing order of the multi-value sections, which would give you lower ones, because there are more of them. Okay. And the philosophy of multiple ideal shift is that whenever you are in trouble, you invoke this metric of sticking in the multiplier. Right? That's all there is. So now, when you don't have the estimates, you stake in the multiplier here. Okay. And you want this thing to be locally integrable. Right? Okay, that's it. Yeah. And then, of course, it depends on this M0. The M0 will be our generators. You don't know what the M0 is supposed to mean. It's some M0. Yeah. So that's also an unknown. Okay. So this is the way to introduce multiple ideal shifts. But of course, introducing it doesn't mean anything, because just a name, then you have to get something out of it. So we know that the actual M section would be bounded by this, adjusted by the epsilon. So we want to get the integrability here. We could be more generous and say that if the soup is bounded, then of course L2 is okay. Okay. Then of course you switch suddenly from L to the soup. Why are you doing it? Well, the reason is that for this kind of thing, it's a matter of blow up and blow down. You take L2. When you blow up, you have to adjust it by the Jacobian determinant. You can do it, of course, it's just more trouble. Every time you have to remember this. Okay. But if you take the soup, then it makes no difference. You blow up, it's the same thing. Right? It's, if the zero z is lower order, it's a lower dimension, let's say a point, and the approach the point in different direction, different order. When you blow up, the point becomes a hypersurface, and then you can say the order in the hypersurface. It's the same as downstairs, except that the jet now would be magnified. Okay. So you take a soup, it just makes things easier. But you pay a price for it, because you take a soup instead of L2, things are no longer coherent. Okay, they're no longer coherent. Okay. But it's worth the price. So let me say some more about the dynamical multiple ideal shift, and we call it dynamical. The reason is that we actually don't know what M0 is. For every M0, there's a multiple ideal shift. Right? And the M0 will serve as a generator. We don't have level, the generation occurs. So we have to consider all M0. So this is what happens. Okay. And also this, because we are using a soup norm, this N plus 2 probably doesn't matter. It's just the order of the multiple ideal that's being used. Okay. We sort of try to get a compromise to get a working multiple ideal sheet that's easy to handle. Okay. So now we are going to introduce our multiple ideal sheaves. So we take the big one, and if you multiply it by something, it's dominated by the one from actual sections. Okay. And of course, a moment ago it's M0, but we don't know which M0, we just call it M. Of course. Yeah. So if you take a coherent sheaf, because we don't know that the whole thing is coherent, because we are using soup norm, so we just take any one and say that this is good enough for our purpose. So we take a coherent sheaf and say that this is less than or equal to that. Okay. And this is the sum of absolute value square of local sections. Okay. So that is what we try to do. Okay. And then there's another thing, namely this epsilon here is up to us to choose. We can choose different epsilons. So if you choose different epsilons, then things would be different. So actually you should say that, well, for every M, we are free to choose a different epsilon, because it doesn't matter what the epsilon is if you know which M works. Okay. So you want to incorporate this one in, then you get the following definition, which I call a discrepancy subspace. So you take a coherent ideal sheaf, and we say that stable vanishing orders achieve modulo this, if this thing is true. Now, we break this up because this is originally is a big phi, okay? These are components of the big phi with the epsilons. So I just embed it here. But you want to do this for every M. That's the key point. That is dynamical, because we want to do this for every M, because we don't know which M is being used. Of course, the challenge is, can you get one coherent ideal sheaf that works for all M? Of course, you can do one for all M. You're welcome. I mean, that's very good. Okay. But if you can do it, then it's called discrepancy subspace. And this is the kind of multiple ideal sheaf that's being used. It measures the failure of the estimate and stick in the, into the crucial part. And so that's the discrepancy subspace. That's the main tool for this kind of thing. So when we compare the values of two functions, it can occur in various jet directions approach. So it may change when your M changes. So I want to emphasize the discrepancy subspace. The discrepancy subspace bounds the order and the location of jet directions of the failure. When you compare two functions here, okay, then of course, these are realistic things, okay? They may approach the point in different directions. And so different jet directions they fail. And if you put in here, actually it bounds already the failure of the jet, because these would have the jets, okay? And also for all M, that is the significance of this situation. It tells you that you don't have to worry about all jets, because it bounds certain jets. Okay, so of course the trouble is that it may vanish on a certain hypersurface, then it only bounds the normal direction, the order normal direction for that. But along the hypersurface, you still do not have bound. So this has to be done lexicographically, so to speak. Okay. So another thing is that when you take discrepancy subspaces, you can take the intersection of them. So you have two of them together like this. Of course, they would start with different ones. And you can just put them together, because you just take the maximum of these two starting points, and that's it. I mean, you just put them together, sum of absolute square works. Okay. Now, this emphasizes the need of doing it dynamically, because if you do it for only a single M0, for example, if another one for another M0, then you cannot put the two together without raising the power of one of them. You raise the power of one of them, you are not actually taking the intersection of space. Okay. Because then the thing runs out of control. Because each time you do it, the other one gets raised to a certain power. Okay. So that's the reason why this dynamical character is very important. So here it is. I mean, you may have to raise a certain power if one is P times that. And then you would get only this one instead of the one that we need. Okay. So now let me tell you something about moving between L2 and subestimates. One of the tools that we have is the global generation multiplier U-shifts. That is in L2. And then we change the sup. Okay. And actually, it is in our favor, actually. Because if you can generate things in the sense of L2, then you have no trouble getting the sup. Because the L2 actually allows you to have a little pole order. So even after you make a little pole order, it still generates. So it's good. So this is the lemma on the sup norm domination of the metric. So if you have holomorphic functions, you take this multi-value one, get a metric, and then if you have local generation, then the local generation have less vanishing order than the original one. Because when you take L2, you allow a little pole. Okay, that's very simple. And Dumais carried this one out in one of his papers. And I didn't read it. Mihai Pawun told me it's there. So it's just that when you say L2, the pole order, a little bit pole order is allowed. Okay. This, originally, I wrote down a pool. He said that it was already there, but it doesn't matter. So here, okay, so let me explain to you the existence of this multiplier ideal shift. Because we put in the condition that it is dynamical. For all M, it works. I mean, the question is whether such a thing exists. And then, of course, if it exists, your way of constructing it, then you try to cut down the space until you get to nothing. I mean, it's the same philosophy as when we're looking at Kong's algorithm, we differentiate it so that we lower its order. And now we have another way of lowering its order until we get to nothing. Okay. But you have to have a way of constructing one first. So let's look at the very simple one. And here is the role of the twisting, the same as the Pooler-Poole genera. You take a sufficiently take an ample Lie bundle, and you assume general type, then you can write it as an ample plus the effective one. Okay. So now you have this metric here. And I could put this in. This is the canonical section of the Lie bundle. So this is a metric for this guy here, which is M plus AKX minus A. Okay. The reason why I'm writing this is to have at my disposal a sufficiently ample Lie bundle to add to. Okay. Because we have to add a sufficiently ample Lie bundle, otherwise we don't get global generation. When we add to it, things will be changed. But if you are able to subtract it first, then of course you can add it back later. But you pay a price for it, namely you have to stick in this D before you can subtract it. So here, for every M, we can do this. And this is globally generated. You stick in an A, you stick in a canonical Lie bundle, then this global generation will allow you to do it independent of M. That's the whole point. That this global generation has nothing to do with the Lie bundle, has nothing to do with the multiple ideal shift. It is only the manifold itself, the sufficient ampleness. So here is the main point. So this globally generates it, and this thing we can rewrite like this. Okay. And by this lemma we had a moment ago about allowing a little bit more pole for L2, we know that the defining ones, which is this one, is less than or equal to the actual section. If they generate the multiplier. Okay. So we have this. This means what? This means that this guy here is the discrepancy subspace. It works for all M. So this is the key point. that you have a global generation multiply ideal shift and the sufficient ampleness has nothing to do with the line bundle and the metric. So dynamically you can define it. Okay. So after you know how to do this, you can use the same recipe to cut down the subspace. Right? The same idea. That you add an ample twisting to it, sufficiently ample, then your global generation, and the price you pay for adding this ample is this vanishing. And this vanishing is the same for all M. Okay. So if you recall what I said about approaching in different directions, different jets, if you have a hyper surface, and if your multiplier ideal in this particular sense for the hyper surface, then there's a bound on the jet direction in the normal direction. Okay? Because there's one is extra in that. But along the tangential one, you don't have it. You don't have any control. So that means that you should repeat the same argument with the hyper surface replacing your ambient manifold. Construct again this kind of thing to cut down on the discrepancy subspace. So you want to decrease the discrepancy subspace. Okay, so what you do is that you have discrepancy subspace y, and you want the same argument applied to y instead of x. And then, of course, you say that, well, there's singularity and so forth. You could always bow up, okay? Because bowing up is simply handling the jets downstairs by looking at various directions. It doesn't change the picture at all, okay? It's a technical thing. And the one hurdle is that if you replace X by this discrepancy space, and try to get the global generation with twisting there, the subspace here is not general type. Okay. So you cannot quite do it. And of course, technically you don't use the canonical line bundle. You use the canonical line bundle modified by the vanishing order on Y. You take the vanishing order across Y and you subtract it. And this one may not be big. Okay, that's the trouble. So you couldn't squeeze out some ample thing. Okay. And how do you handle it? You handle it by essentially looking at some vibration, because they are not big, but there are quite a number of sections. And you actually look at generation for these things. If they have no section, then you don't really worry that much. They have a lot of sections, so the roots cannot be compared to the actual sections. So then, of course, you could use this section to try to get some vibration. Now, I say that it's essentially the same as vibration, but not exactly. So I explain to you technically the more delicate points. So after you do that, then you apply the previous argument to the parametrizing space of the vibration and cut it down and so forth. Okay. So the question is whether you get this vibration thing at all. So first of all, I'd like to remark about this rationality, because a moment ago we had this thing here, and if this is not rational, you have trouble with the line bundle to start out with. You see, all the procedures involves L2 estimate and so forth. You can round up and round down a little bit. Okay. So if it's not rational, you could actually round up, round down, and you get a smaller vanishing order, which is a contradiction. So that's how you handle the rationality is this kind of argument. Okay. And now let's understand what essential means. Okay. Essential means that we look at this guy here. Okay. But the trouble is that this guy may not have enough sections. I mean, there's a gap between the section and general type. I mean, you may not have sections. So we again use our old trick of adding some sufficiently ample thing to get global generation. Okay. So we get sections of these things. Okay. You then you take the order of growth of these sections, And how do you get these fibers? So first of all, you stick in the A, and then look at the number of sections here, and if it grows as a function of the M, and if the growth is a certain order, then you can make them vanish to a certain order at certain points, and then you take the roots and so forth. And on the fiber, the orders are more or less the same. Well, up to a gap of N, because there's a difference between integrability and this N. Okay, so you then taking the Q's root. The reason why I take the Q root is to get rid of this thing. Okay, because later you can use the general type to squeeze out a little bit to get rid of this. Okay, when you use it, you pay a price to increase the singularity a little bit, but when you use L2 estimate, it doesn't really matter that much. Okay, so this process is very much analogous to root-taking argument in the deformation invariance of Purie genera here. Okay. So you want to handle the fact that this may not be big. So you don't know what the order of growth is, but you stick an A that's sufficiently ample to make sure that you have global generation so you can detect the order more properly. And then you get section vanishing to high order at certain points, and then take roots and so forth. And then the fiber we identified would vanishing to some comparable order. Okay. So this argument works only if you have this thing going to infinity so that you can get vanishing order and so forth. So that may happen or they may not happen. If it happens, we say that Y is in the first case of some dichotomy, otherwise in the second case. Okay. So why do I call this dichotomy? Because when you look at the current of the curvature would tell you how positive the Lyman bundle is. Of course, we cannot accept of any positivity. So there's a canonical decomposition of the current, and the shape of the decomposition would tell you which case Y is in. So we have discussed the two cases separately. So first, let's recall the thing about a low number is just a density number. So you have a closed positive current, which is the curvature current that's being used. So you take the trace and you integrate over bore and compare it to the volume of bore one dimension lower. The reason is that the current sort of like harbor surface, so it's one dimension lower. And so this is the trace and so forth. And the limit is the low number. So the set of points with a low number is bigger than something, the subvariety, which is called a long set. Okay, so these are the references for a low number. And we'll have a surface, then integration over regular points, define closed positive current, and the low number is the multiplicity. Okay, so these are just elementary things. And here is the dichotomy. You take a closed positive 1-1 current on a complex manifold X, then you can always take out the hypersurface part. You can uniquely decompose in such a fashion that the Vj would be a hypersurface, and the R is the remainder. The remainder has the property that the long sets would be of codimension at least 2. Okay, so this is taking away the codimension 1 singularity. So the dichotomy is that in the first place, in the first case, either R is non-zero or this is infinite. In the second case, is the R is 0 and the J is finite. So we look at the situation. I don't have. If you allow me to go over time a little bit, okay, so that I don't have to really accelerate my speed of speaking. So, but you are free to go when it's time. You don't. I may have to go over a little bit. So here you take the x that we had with, And then there's the curvature current of this metric of minimum singularity or maximum regularity. And why is one singular hypersurface? Whether singular or not singular, doesn't matter. You can always blow up to handle these things. And then gamma is the generic stable vanishing order across Y. Okay, so it's equal to a low number at a generic point of Y. Then when you want to retrick the curvature to Y, you will take away the singularity part first before you do it. So I call this modified restriction. It could be easily defined. And then we say it's in the first case of the dichotomy. If this one is in the first case, that means either infinite sum of codimension 1 close positive currents, or the remainder is non-zero. Okay. Otherwise, it's the second case. So let's look at this vibration. So the thing is to tell you this, how this vibration thing worked. Okay. So first, let's concentrate on the cybersurface as a manifold first. To see how do you use this dichotomy situation. So we just abstractly looking at the manifold and looking at something that's sufficiently ample. Let's say very ample, minus canonical bundle, very ample, and so forth. Okay. And then it's a line bundle with a metric, this curvature. So this curvature actually will be the modified restriction. Okay. So we have become positioned like this. And first type means that either this is non-zero or this is infinite. And the conclusion is that in that case, the growth of the dimension would be infinite for some subsequence. This allows us to get at least a codimension 1 vibration, so to speak. Okay, so that is one goal. And how do you handle this? So how do you make sure this is this growth? So first of all, because we have this ample thing, we can slice by this ample thing to go into a curve C. And then because we have the ample line bundle, we can slice it and we can do the extension of the sections too. Why do you want to do this slicing? Because when you have a non-singular curve, any torsion-free shape is locally free. Okay, that's the reason we handle it. And we can use Riemann-Roch. And the vanishing theorem of Kawamata feedback NATO for this first cohomology would be zero. Because you add a little bit, there's a little bit positivity. And then you multiply ideal shapes, so all these things would be for cohomology zero. So if you want to look at a section, you only need to look at Riemann-Roch. Okay. So Riemann-Roch, you want to compute the Chern number and the genus. Genus is fixed. And you look at the Chern number, the main point is that if R is not zero, then it doesn't matter because you will multiply this by the P nu, and that would go to infinity already. Okay. And R is zero, then you want to use the fact that this is infinite. Okay. There is a round-up thing a little bit. So you have a Chern number be like this, no trouble. But then you want to make sure that the sections belong to the multiple ideal. Why do you want that? Because you want to extend all the way back. If it doesn't belong to multiple ideal shape, you cannot extend all the way back. So you subtract this and you still gain a little bit. And when it's the infinite number, then the Kronecker theorem or Diophantine approximation, we say that you have a sequence. Because the thing is that the sum has to be finite. The sum of these things have to be finite. So these things will be getting smaller and smaller. When you round up, the gap gets rather big, so it can become infinite. It's a rather complicated thing when things are not rational. Okay. But there's a Kronecker theorem that will help you do this kind of thing. Okay. Because you can approximate to some prescribed thing. That's why you can get this extra gap. So this actually is the key to handle this case. So you get a little bit of positivity from the Diophantine approximation and from the remainder. So now we look at this hypersurface as inside original manifold. So everything is the same as before, except that if you have generic stable vanishing order, you have to subtract it first. And then the canonic decomposition looks like this. Okay. So then we have the conclusion. After you stick in something that is sufficiently ample, we have this conclusion that the growth becomes infinite from the Diophantine approximation and the non-vanishing of the remainder. So this is rather delicate because it's a dichotomy. Either you would squeeze out certain growth of the dimensionless section module or not. Okay. Now, we want to get rid of the ample line bundle that we put in. We have to take roots and so forth to get rid of it because it's not welcome, because you get these sections, we stick it in, it's not allowed. So how do we get rid of it? We get rid of it by going to the metric. You see, we could get rid of it by taking roots and so forth and then use the general type situation to get rid of it. Okay. But you have to pay a price. Namely, you have to increase the singularity a little bit across the hypersurface. Because when you write down the canonical line bundle as an ample plus an effective divisor, the effective divisor may contain your hypersurface as one component. So there is some contribution there. Okay. But when it comes to multiply ideal shift, it doesn't matter. If you just move a little bit, it doesn't matter. Okay. So we go to the metrics instead of actual sections, which is the same thing that we did for the deformation invariance of pluri-genera. Remember, we get rid of it by taking roots, by going to the metric. And we pay a price, but the price doesn't affect the L2. So we go to the metric, and we can use it to get the extension. The same situation here. Okay. So we want to get a metric. And what is the special thing about this metric? Because we cannot use Osawa, Tagawashi, anything, because we don't have anything to extend. All we did was that we get some sections that have extra vanishing order along Y. The sections would have stable vanishing order, at least, across Y. Because all sections have that, even all multivariate sections of that. But because of the growth of the dimension of the section space, we are able to get extra vanishing. Okay. So those are extra additional singularities on hypersurface of first case of the dichotomy. Okay. So let me look at that statement. So here is the conclusion. So we take a point, and we are able to get a metric for this without adding an A now. Without adding an A. And this is sum of S-value squares of multivariate sections. And you pay a price. The vanishing order of this is more than 2 Chabot P times alpha. Okay. There's a 2 because this is S-value square. You have to allow it to the epsilon. The price you pay for getting rid of the A. Because you get the ampleness from the canonical line bundle. And you write down canonical line bundle as ample plus the effective divisor may have Y as a component, so you need a little bit more. And then the extra vanishing order additional is 2n. Okay. The curvature current is strictly positive on Y because you use the general type already. So this is the way to get additional singularities for a metric. Okay. Then you say, what is the use of getting additional metric singularity? Because that's how you do the Fujita conjecture, that you get extra vanishing so that you can concentrate on the subspace of extra vanishing. Because when you normalize, then the original vanishing doesn't play a role anymore. The extra vanishing now becomes the important thing. And that's how you cut down on the dimensional space. Okay, so that's how it works. So you keep on cutting down, and of course in the case of Fujita conjecture, you get to a case of a point, isolated singularity, and then you extend back. And here things are more complicated. So each time you do this, to get additional singularity so that you can concentrate on the subspace. So this is what I said, that I pay a price for it, except that it's written down. So here, sufficiently high order roots, you get rid of the ample line bundle. You pay a price because when you write a sum, the effective divisor may contain y in support. And then you have to have a slightly higher singularity across y, but it doesn't matter much. Okay? Because compared to the additional singularity at one point, this is nothing. Okay? And the additional singularity can be as high as you want. Of course, the point is, you get additional singularity at one point, you get some bonus as well. Because there are other points with the same singularity. That's why you get the vibration, the comparable singularities. And when you take the multiple ideal shift and the subspace, these extra bonus would go with that point. That's why you get the vibration. And the order vanishing may not be the same, but it's between certain gaps, like n times that or something. Okay? So here is the vibration I told you a moment ago, that you are vanishing high order, but then there are other points vanishing high order as well. It's sort of, there's a gap, so it doesn't matter, n is very large, the gap. Okay. So you get the vibration from that, those are the bonus vanishing points. But the vibration itself, the sub-variety, is not the main point. The ideal shift is, because the multiple ideal shift is the one that is being used to extend sections back. Just the set, you cannot extend it. So you sort of normalize and make the multiple ideal shift, and the subspace has to be defined by the multiple ideal shift, okay, not by the set. So now let me say something about the eventual occurrence of the second case of the dichotomy. I mentioned that in the case of Fujita conjecture, it is the same idea that you get multivariate section with extra vanishing and then create additional singularities for the metric. And then when you normalize, your attention goes to the subspace and keep on cutting it until you get to a point. Okay? And then you can extend from a point. Therefore, you can always get freeness. Now, freeness is good enough. Why is it good enough? Because freeness is precisely what you look for, that you can actually get an actual section that has the vanishing order as multivariate sections. The multivariate sections are the ones from which you get the metric, which defines the multiple ideal shift. When you actually get global generation, then you have a comparable order. So that's what you need. But you cannot cut it down to a point, because the second case of the dichotomy always occurs. Why? Let me explain to you. If it doesn't occur, you have a contradiction. Namely, you have no stable vanishing order to start out with. Why? Because when you extend from a subspace out, you always use vanishing theorems to help you extend. Right? That's how you do it. Okay. And when you use vanishing theorem, you always add a k. Okay. So there's a stable vanishing order that goes to the y, which is alpha. But if you extend, you must have vanishing, must have multiplied ideal shift here, you are adding a k. You end up with a section with m plus 1. So, but yet the vanishing order is m alpha. That would be a contradiction. Okay. So that means that you are not able to just extend from the y, and then you say, how do you get rid of the contradiction? The contradiction comes in, it depends on whether in the extension you are able to find this vanishing order on y to extend. If what you have to extend has more vanishing order than specified, then it doesn't matter anymore. So that is the case, the second case of the dichotomy. So if you don't get a second case of dichotomy, you are in trouble. Another way to see why you are in trouble is that these things are done by multiple ideal shifts, and a little bit of wiggling doesn't change the multiple ideal shift. So that means that the vanishing order is not supposed to be very strict. You can always perturb a little bit if you do it that way. And that's no, you cannot, you're not supposed to do it. So that means that you can never get down to a point. So if you cannot get down to a point, at some time, some of the fibers would be the second case of the dichotomy. Okay. So what happens is the second case of dichotomy. Okay. So you keep on cutting down. Every time your first case of dichotomy, you can repeat this argument of twisting, taking roots, blah, blah, and so forth. Until you get the second case of dichotomy, you cannot do it anymore. And that second kind of thing looks like this. And this is finite, and this is rational. So you could use these to construct a section. A section like this. If it's M is sufficiently divisible, you can construct a section. But this section is not a section of this bundle, because this section is for a bundle that has the same curvature. Okay. And it differs possibly by a flat line bundle. That is one of the trouble with the second case. Because when you look at this, this is just a curvature. So you can get a section for a line bundle that has the same curvature. It doesn't mean that it's the original one. There's a flat bundle there. And that occurred way back already. And Shokurov handled it in 95. This is Shokurov's technique. Shokurov thing, they say that, well, you have a section for this line bundle after you twist it with a flat bundle, but this is what you want. And you have multiplied ideal all the way, and you can wiggle a little bit because you have general type. Okay, so they are vanishing of cohomologies higher. And if you apply Riemann-Roch, then the right-hand side doesn't matter because this is flat. And if you have a section for one, you have a section for the other. That's the called the Shukurov trick of handling the flat twisting. And you get a section. So you get a section when you get to the second case, and then you use it to extend all the way back. Okay. So this extension would help you cut down the discrepancy subspace to one lower dimension, and you keep on doing it. Okay. So the lexicographical argument here would help you control the jets. Maybe I should skip because there's another thing, the application to complex Riemann problem is algebraic geometry, and this is a good point to quit, I think. Yeah.